Hello there, it's me again, Michelle Cortins, with the information you've been waiting for. This episode is part two on the apple scab disease. In part one, you met our guest and learned about the organism responsible for apple scab infections. Remember, spores are discharged from the leaf litter, and like seeds, they need the proper conditions to germinate and establish. But if you haven't listened to part one, you should give it a go first. On part two now, our guest will answer questions about management practices, including fungicides, modeling, and orchard sanitation. So here he is again, and the passionate pathology continues, with our guest, Dr. Surgeon Achimovich. Why are single-site products used if they need to be tank-mixed with a multi-site product anyway?
There is one important disadvantage of the multi-site fungicides. And the most important disadvantage is that they are contact fungicides. So they basically protect the tissue where they fall. So they're basically, in other words, they are not able to be absorbed into the leaves. And being, you know, having that contact mode of action also then exposes them to different factors, such as amount of rain that they're being exposed to. Meaning they can be washed away and the residues can decline. And with this residue, concentration decline on the leaf surface and fruit surface, you get less effect or, you know, less efficacy in controlling scab. So that's why the, you know, investigation in the chemical companies led to, you know, single site fungicides, because they had different properties. And one of the most important properties why they were developed was the ability to absorb them into the leaves. And that seemed to be crucial in certain cases, because sometimes you get these years when you have constant rain for, you know, a week or 10 days. And in these cases, what really matters is when you apply your fungicide before the rain, to have these single site fungicides present in the leaf tissue, you know, while that rain actually is occurring. And so you're going to later ask me about some other abilities of these fungicides, but these single site fungicides are, you know, not, you know, because they penetrate in the leaves, and we call them local systemic or systemic, depending on their ability, how far they can go into the tissue. They basically then in that case have also ability to, you know, reach inside if the infection has occurred before. You know, and we did not have anything on the trees, or basically any fungicide on the trees to protect the trees. So that ability to penetrate into the leaves, also offers the ability to kill the infections that have established just because they're able to penetrate inside.
Okay, so why should using fungicides for that kind of kickback activity be reserved for only emergency situations, say if there wasn't enough fungicide applied pre-infection?
Yes. So there has been a period, right, I would say about 20, 25 years ago when the demethylation inhibitors, we also call them, it's a class of fungicides. We also call them triazoles, or we call them sterol inhibitors. And the reason why they're called like that is because they inhibit in the fungus this specific important pathway that allows formation of sterols that are, you know, really important building compounds that allow the fungus to grow. So when in that past period, you know, that trait of having a kickback activity, meaning that when you, let's say you didn't have any material applied before the rain, and then you had your sprayer broken, right? You weren't able to get out there to spray, then you would have, that would in my mind, the emergency. You have the ability to apply the fungicide after the rain and reach back, meaning allow that fungicide to be absorbed and kill the infections that have established. So we realized based on that past experiences that when you apply fungicide this way, that somehow leads to development of resistance, or at least it adds a certain level of speed in getting that resistance to move into the population of the Venturia inequalis fungus. So there is, of course, many potential hypotheses why that is the case. But, the idea behind it is that when you are having an already ongoing infection, that you have already allowed this huge amount of ascospores that are out there, right, to infect, Now, when you're applying that fungicide, you're exposing this large population of ascospores that are now effectively growing and progressing with their hyphae under the cuticle to infect. And there is this, hypothesis that the reason why you have, you are quickening resistance by applying this way is because you have that large population of spores exposed. And in that case, there's a higher percentage of chance that you might have mutations in the fungus. And that those mutations then eventually can be selected by this huge pressure that you apply by applying fungicides on an ongoing infections. And that, that means that, you're increasing the chance of getting the selection of these specific, hyphae having this mutation that, carries the resistance to the fungicide. And then eventually, if you keep doing, applying that practice from year to year, if you keep on depending on applying fungicides every 14 days or every 10 days, which would be the post-infection mode, what eventually happens after 3, 4, 5 years, you get this resistant population, which means that one individual which had that mutation now is now no longer one individual. It's maybe about 10 in the second or third year. And then by the year 5, you have about maybe 150 to 2000 individuals. And then now the population shifts, in the presence of just regular scab strain to a more resistant strain of scab. In the last, I would say, 15 years, the prevailing opinion within the, plant protection and the plant pathology communities is that we don't recommend anymore applying fungicides this way as a regular practice. We call it only emergency practice, meaning if you really must, if you had some kind of a problem, like your sprayer broke down, you didn't have a part, or you didn't have a, product delivered to you, or, you just were caught off guard and you didn't have any material before because, there's this prolonged rain of 5 to 6 days that it was lasting, then that is your really the only option, but that's reserved only as an emergency.
Okay. So really focus on prevention and protective fungicides. Yeah.
And let me just explain something. Okay. There's still a lot of growers, okay, who still feel that they should, that in their mindset, that they should come and apply the fungicide after the rain, because they should be covered then, and then because they feel like, okay, well, I need that protection and coverage in between the times when I'm gonna spray. Like I need something to be on my leaves, after the rain, because I'm open, right? So that's actually completely the opposite. You have to have your fungicide on your trees before the rain so that you can be protected during that rain. That's where you get the protection. And earlier when you asked me a question about, the contact fungicides and why do we have to use single site and multi-site, mm-hmm. I omitted to mention one important thing. The multi-site fungicides, besides their property of being contacted, they have the ability to simultaneously attack multiple pathways in the fungus. And meaning that the fungi cannot really, they cannot really develop resistance because, these fungicides impact those pathways that are quite fundamental in their synthesis of the biological compounds that are necessary for their functioning. So, and they are not, the fungi cannot really develop resistance to these multi-site fungicides. So that's why they are essential. And basically what they do is they catch up these contact fungicides because they're multi-site. They catch up the load of control in the cases where you have maybe potentially resistance in the population of apple scab fungus to the single site fungicides. And that's why we recommend it. But we did talk also about the rain and of course the temperature, but it's not only about that as well. It's about the growth stage. It's about the amount of the green tissue that you have. So, many growers forget that, when you get warm weather, of course, they don't forget really, they actually know, but I keep on trying to remind them that when you have rain during the warm weather, your leaf tissue, your green tissue is basically expanding its surface. So it's not only about, trying to protect against the infection itself, but it's also trying to cover that leaf surface that is progressively developing as the warm weather comes. And, so contact fungicides are not able to, or many of them are not able to redistribute during the rain to cover that new tissue that is being developed during the rain. That's another reason why, you know, systemic fungicides are, or the single site fungicides, are, you know, are, you know, again, picking up the slack, because they have the ability to be protected from the rain being in the tissue. And they, you know, they when they enter the tissue, they follow that tissue expansion and they can protect from infections. Whereas the contact fungicides leave gaps behind them when the tissue starts expanding.
Okay, I'm glad you went back to that. Those were some good comments to add. Yeah. So we've been hearing more and more about biological fungicides lately. What are the challenges of using those?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, there has been literature reports, okay, of certain, you know, super parasites, the way how we call them, a certain fungi that potentially can, you know, or we hoped they could be commercialized to, you know, potentially be useful biocontrol. When we pathologists talk about biocontrol, we specifically think about an organism against an organism. We want to go and find certain organisms against that are, you know, in that scheme of things, right, able to antagonize or prevent development of a certain pathogen. And one of the first examples was Ampelomyces fungi, which have been found, they can parasitize, you know, the apple scab fungus. But, you know, it has never been commercialized, you know, because there's, you know, it's a living organism that you have to now manipulate. And it's a living organism now that you have to preserve, to make a product that can be shelf stable, that can be, you know, sitting in your storage before somebody purchases it. And that proved to be a huge challenge with biocontrol agents in many different respects. So far, I've scoured the literature over and over, you know, just preparing for this podcast, and I've not really seen much out there. I've recently also saw a paper on Cladosporium fungus H39 strain that has been proven to have a certain efficacy. But you know, really the way how this process goes is the companies that then follow up after that research, they end up having this huge task to try to, you know, develop a formulation. And meaning, you know, that's, it's a whole science in and of itself, because from formulating a product, I mean, first of all, you have to design, right, and find an active compound or a biological control agent. Then now there's this cumbersome process of trying to develop a formulation, and that's not easy. A lot of people forget that chemical companies invest huge amount of money, and other plant protection companies invest huge amount of money to develop a formulation that allows this product or biocontrol agent to stay stable. And not only when you have it in the package, but also stay stable and active when you apply it. And so right now, as of this point, I have not heard of, for instance, the Cladosporium being commercialized yet, because I assume, and you know, I presume there's a lot of, you know, these steps that are still not being, you know, successfully dealt with. So that's where the difficulty is. You know, how do you really work with a live organism? And I'll just briefly kind of lean on another example. For instance, a fire blight pathogen that we briefly talked about before. That's where the main battle is right now, trying to develop biocontrol agents that are effectively controlling this pathogen. And it's proven to be difficult because it depends on the weather conditions, right? Maybe it works in the West Coast in certain conditions because they have different conditions there. And it doesn't work in East Coast because we have different weather conditions here. You know, high levels of humidity, you know, outbursts of really warm weather. And in those cases, these biocontrol agents really don't perform the same way, because when you have these conditions change, they impact the way how the plant reacts to these temperatures. And for instance, the bloom is not anymore like 7 to 10 days. Or maybe like 5 days, it doesn't last that long. And certain biocontrol agents require that, you know, that stage to last that much, because they require time to build up their populations on the flowers. So that's the reason I'm just using that as an example or analogy of what potentially could just go into play in how these biocontrol agents function. And I'll mention to you an example for scab, okay? So I visited New Zealand in 2018 for the International Fruit Tree Association tour to just learn how the apple industry looks like. And we visited this farm in New Zealand. It's called Bostock. And they have been heavily involved in developing spray programs and, you know, producing actually organic apples. And one of the things that they have there registered is this biocontrol agent called Panthera agglomerans. And it's called Blossom Blast. That's the product they use. But what I wanted to tell you is that it would never be allowed to be labeled here in the United States because of the certain concerns about respiratory and skin exposure. There's, it's a toxicant for people who might work in the orchard. So certain biocontrol agents are, having that also that other side of it, which is, okay, what is their toxicology profile? What is their environmental fate? And those are quite cumbersome things that a chemical company or a plant health company has to go through before they can commercialize something. They have to prove all these things that they are not harmful, that, the destiny of, of this organism, once it's released, it's, not going to be detrimental to any environmental, parameters like a flora and fauna that is present there. So that's the reason why we don't see much for apple scab yet in terms of biological control.
Yeah, because even if it's biological, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have associated health risks as well.
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately, yes, very unique are examples where you can find some biocontrol agent that works really well and has a really good profile, from all these other, perspectives that are important to EPA and other agencies that really look into how these organisms, what happens with these organisms in the environment after we apply them.
Mm-hmm. So if there is a soft fungicide available, then when would it be most appropriate to start trying it in a spray schedule?
There really needs to be much more research before we know exactly, okay? But I'll give you a my own perspective on how would I approach to apply these products. The best approach really is to apply them when you have drier periods, and also periods where you don't have excessive wetness, because they're going to perform really, really well in those cases. And meaning that when the infection pressure is medium to low, whatever the efficacy that the biologicals have, you can maybe get a good control. And going back to that example with Fireblight, that's where actually a lot of people have tried to persuade a lot of other, scientists that, we do see effect. But, many times what people don't realize is what is the actual infection pressure behind it. And when we do inoculated trials at the experiment stations, we provide high inoculum level, and then we want to see how the system functions, how that product functions under heavy load. And that means if you have high wetness, high percentage of ascospores being released, how does this product, function? So it's one thing what you see in your orchard, commercial orchard, in certain years. And the other thing is what we do in experiments, and we want to see how system functions when everything is overloaded. So that's what we do. But in that specific case, we do recommend certain fungicides as well, which are synthetic, not only organic approved fungicides, but also and also biocontrol agents. We do recommend them at the times when you have medium to low infection pressures, because they can do some effect there. But when the strong infection pressures occur, that's where we can't really rely yet on these products. I'll also mention something else. In these other cases of, these other pathogens on apple that are important and that people develop or have been developing, companies have been developing organic or biocontrol agents, you need to reapply them frequently. And that adds to a higher load, higher workload or labor load on the growers and their work crews. And so in these cases, in certain cases, certain commercial growers say this, it becomes very unpopular to reapply these products because that if you want to achieve certain effect, you have to reapply them frequently. So go back to your question, if I would ever see any effective, biocontrol for scab, I would probably apply it the same way how I would apply fungicides that I know don't have really a great effect against scab.
Okay, so this kind of leads into the next question. How can modeling programs be used to help manage apple scab infections? So I know you've already mentioned RIMPRO a little bit. Yeah,
so I mentioned RIMPRO because I have been working with it before. And I'm not really mentioning it from the perspective that, you know, I'm really clinched on just using that model. There's other models that people use. And, you know, if you go to New Zealand, they have their own, you know, plant food and research corporation, governmental corporation has developed their own, you know, modeling system as well. But I have been really fascinated by RIMPRO, and specifically these models can do something that is important that I have not seen so far other models being able to do. RIMPRO model can give you the insight into what is going to be the severity of infection for each wedding event. And that's quite a unique trait. And the reason why it's important to know that is because, and it has been actually developed for organic growers. The RIMPRO started, you know, developing apple scab model because there has been need by organic growers to know when the germination of the ascospores happens. They need to know that because certain organic products like potassium bicarbonate, you know, really depend and it can be specifically effective on that growth stage when the germinating infection hyphae develops from the spore. So then, you know, RIMPRO has been developed for that specific purpose to give the insight when the germination is happening, when the ascospores are being released. So you have these really nice graphic representation of really what how many ascospores are being released. And then after that, you know, the model also shows you what is the percentage of those spores that were released, how many of them actually have successfully established infection. So that it's not the same, right? You know, you can have stuff released, but you need conditions that change, you know. So the model is really dynamic in that sense. It has the ability to know what's happening during those hours after the spores are being released. And when you have the ability to know what is the percentage of ascospores that does establish infection, it shows you on that scale, you know, what is that percentage of ascospores and how much of them establish infection, which I have not seen other models that are able to do. And that is very important because you can select your fungicides depending on what infection, you know, you are anticipating having, because the model, right, uses weather forecast as well. So you have the historical data that you collect from your weather outlet or your weather station. And then you have a prediction, you know, or 4, 5, maybe even 10 days. But, you know, it's too far to kind of be reliable to use, you know, anything beyond, I would say, 72 hours. But if you're looking ahead, you're seeing that weather forecast coming and you see that rain coming. And if you see a really strong infection, you know, coming ahead, because that's what the model right now with the temperature and wetness that is being predicted is telling you is going to come, then I would use certain fungicides that are much more potent. They're, you know, synthetic fungicides that are able, they're systemic, they're able to get into the tissue. And, you know, also amount of rain plays a huge important role. In this specific case, that also drives the infections as well, and also the temperature. So when you have severe infection coming, you know, ahead of you, then you would gauge your response in terms of what fungicides you use. But if you have a mild infection or low infection, you know, below a certain threshold, so RIMPRO has the ability to tell, you know, and it gives us the ability to use thresholds, which is something that, you know, we were jealous of, you know, entomologists, they were using thresholds for decades now. But now we have the same thing for commercial orchards that didn't have scab in the past. We have a threshold of 300, basically a RIMPRO value, which is the 3% of ascospores being, you know, so anything below 3% ascospores in commercial orchards in the RIMPRO basically tells you you don't have to apply any fungicides or basically you can apply contact fungicides to control these infections because they are mild. They're or low or mild and they're not going to be really powerful. Whereas if you have a really orchard that has been pestered with this disease last year, you had infections, then that threshold goes down to 100. And basically, you know, you need 1% of ascospores. That 100 actually is 1% of ascospores that allows you to infect. And if you had, you know, scab from last year, then in that case, your threshold lowers down and you have to apply fungicides for anything between 100 and 300 or above. So that's another beauty of that model that can help you design what you want to do in terms of the selection of the fungicides. And finally, the one of the other advantages, because it's kind of difficult to really kind of list them all, but I'm picking up some of them that are important. One of them is that specific ability to look and know whether certain release of ascospores with certain wetting allowed the infections to really occur. So Rimpro has the unique ability to show you separately, you know, the spore release from the infections themselves happening. And many times you can see that the conditions for ascospores were not conducive. You did have a release of ascospores, but then the infection has not occurred after that. And that's a unique ability of this model to give you an insight. So in certain cases, when you have those indications that infection did not happen after the release, then you don't have to apply fungicides for those cases. And that happens from time to time. Every second or the third year, you can have that happen. And in those cases, you don't have to apply fungicides. You can save your money and not apply certain early season scab fungicides to protect. The model is quite reliable and gives you the ability to tell you, well, it's too cold. You know, it's too cold. There's not enough warmth requirements for the pathogen to continue allowing infection to happen. It's just basically those infection hyphae abort and they die. And that's something that, you know, other static models don't have. And that's that, you know, that's the beauty of using those models. But I'm sure you're going to ask the next question. What are
the limitations?
Yeah. One of the most interesting limitations of these models is really it's the weather forecast instability. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we like to think, right, that certain outlets give us better prediction of the weather, but many of these models come with certain default models for weather forecast that come with it. And in those cases, depending on how good the models are that meteorologists have implemented, you know, and whatever the outlet they are using, that also heavily influences the output from the model as well, especially in that forecast, you know, 5 to 7 day period ahead of us. And some years, these models for prediction work really well. And then also the model, because of that, also works really well. But in some cases, we have seen, you know, for days, you know, prediction for let's say five, six days in the past, the prediction was telling us there's going to be a huge rain event. And then all of a sudden, that risk dissipates and there's no rain event. But so that's a challenge. The way how that can be overcome is, of course, trying to work with these companies that outsource these models, to work with them to allow many different sources and outlets of data that flows from different, countries that have different models, and their meteorologists, you know, using different models for forecast weather, to use better and better models for prediction of weather to be incorporated into these models. But it has not been perfect in that sense. So what that does is, you know, it kind of creates a problem for growers, right? Because they need to go out and start applications maybe 2-3 days before they can cover the whole orchard. So some of them have large acreage, and that plays an important role when they start applying. So some of them can't really do 24 to 48 hour coverage. They need more. So having something like that that is stable in terms of weather forecast and then makes the disease infection forecast stable as well is of huge importance, because many other growers who have large acreage, they start spraying early. So they can end up just before the rain starts and the infection starts to occur.
And I'm also curious about leaf wetness sensors. Do you have experience with them, and are they used in these models? Do they seem trustworthy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have per se myself in research experience with them, with using, you know, and trying to find the differences between the models. But by and large, based on the body of literature and also other, you know, much more experienced, pathologists who have worked over the years with apple scab, leaf wetness sensors are a huge and very important parameter for these models to function properly. The way how they function is they measure basically the voltage differences. They basically have a conductor, and the water goes over that conductor, and depending on how long that wetness, you know, is there, that voltage change is really recorded. And then we know exactly if also if we have to place them close to or in the canopy. That is really giving us the most important parameter besides temperature, right? You know, how long the leaves are going to be wet. And these sensors, depending on how well they built, and they can create, you know, malfunction. You know, they're not really free of problems. And you know, with more and more research that has been done in the past, these sensors became better and better. One important thing for growers to know is if they do have a weather station, we would definitely recommend servicing it every second year. You know, sometimes it can be as simple as maybe a bird came in and made the nest on the sensor, and that's why it's not working properly. So just by, you know, going by your station and looking, is everything okay? Do you see a loose wire somewhere, or do you see something like that? And the other thing is, what we always recommend to make sure that you have correct data is at least have two weather stations on your property, meaning that you have a backup. And, you know, trust your eyes as well. You know, if you do see that, well, you know, one sensor is really showing exactly what's happening. If you go out to your orchard and you see, yes, the leaves are really wet at this point, and this weather station shows me that there is a leaf wetness and it's lasting this amount of time, and whereas this other one is giving us this really output that we doubt, something else is, you know, being shown here, then that way you kind of have a control, right? You kind of compare one station to another. That's something that's very important, and we try to encourage people to do that, besides the fact, of course, to service it.
Okay, good point. Okay, so now we're thinking about maybe next season already. What can be done to reduce disease pressure for the next season?
One of the things that we always try to recommend is, you know, to instill in the growers' minds this notion of how did your last season look like in terms of the scab pressure? You know, what did you have issues in certain block? If you did have scab, even a little bit in your orchard, then the sanitation that I'm going to talk about now is something I would absolutely recommend. I would never skip it in that case. I understand growers who have never had scab. They have a low level of tolerance for anything, including scab. And they have a perfect, you know, spray schedule. They don't want to take any, you know, they have brokers, they have, you know, their chain worked out, you know, where they're going to go and sell their apples. They don't want to risk it. They need to invest in money in fungicides and programs and everything, and they don't have scab. In those cases, when you had not had a recent history from scab infections previous year, you might not need to apply, you know, and do your sanitation, because, you know, we're taking this assumption that, you know, the infection spore dose is going to be very low or non-existent, okay, in your orchard. So it's a philosophy again, right? It's an art how you approach this stuff, and you can skip it. But if you had issues with scab, we would, or if you have, unfortunately, you know, this is kind of unpopular to say, but if your neighbor had scab in their orchard, then in that case, you know, I would recommend sanitation measures. And one of the most popular ones was applying urea on your trees. We usually recommend 40 pounds rate per acre. And what that does is, so you can apply it either in fall when your leaves are still on the canopy, but as close as possible to first frost so that you can get those leaves to drop after you apply. And the rationale behind applying urea is to provide nutrients for different organisms in the soil that live in and on the surface of the soil. And they basically use that nitrogen as a source and they basically can help degrade the leaf litter. And that can help a lot, because by this practice, you can reduce the spore dose in your orchard by a 50% based on the research that has been done in New York in the past that has been shown to add that. So somebody can say, well, you know, that's not enough. I want 100% kill. Well, this is not one of those silver bullet, you know, like fungicide clear cut, you know, perfect control solution, right? This is a general sanitation method. You know, similar to the sanitation methods we use to prevent potential infections from the COVID-19, right? You know, we use ethanol, we wash hands, we do anything we can to, you know, get these fomites these surfaces disinfected so we don't get the contact spread of the virus. This is the same option, right? There's no guarantee this is going to be 100% successful, but there's a reason why we do it. And the reason is when you reduce that spore load, what you're going to then do is you're going to allow your fungicides that you apply later to be much more efficient. You're kind of securing their efficacy, their better efficacy by reducing that spore load. You know, they don't have to work that harder by reduction of that load. The other option besides applying it when the leaves are still on the canopy is you can actually still apply it, anywhere during the winter when there is no snow cover. And you can, many growers decide to do it in spring while the leaf litter is basically on the ground, right? So you can deflect your nozzles, turn off the nozzles on the top of your sprayer and just use the bottom nozzles and get your air blast fan to kind of lift these leaves off the ground and get the, urea to, coat the leaves as much as possible and allow these organisms to degrade the leaf litter. So urea is not an option in organic orchards, okay? Because it's a synthetic product. And in that specific case, and I know this is very unpopular, but lime, dolomitic lime is potentially something you can use to disperse on the orchard. And that also, what that does is it increases the basic pH level on the leaves and allows microorganisms to become more active. And that also then indirectly leads to degradation of the leaf litter. And so anything that you can do to degrade leaf litter. The other thing with sanitation that is important to realize is that when you decide to do something like this, allow yourself a good dry day that you can actually drive the tractor through the orchard, because in those cases, you might have issues and people, get distraught a little bit, by trying to use that. Organic growers also can use, and conventional growers can use, flail mowers. So if they have a crew of people or if they have any kind of machine that can rake the leaves out below the canopy on the ground, rake those leaves in the middle of the mid row, then you can use the flail mower and use the scalp mode to kind of shred the leaves as much as possible to smaller pieces. And shredding the leaves in smaller pieces is going to allow these organisms, microorganisms, to degrade the leaf litter faster, and that way prevent the conditions for the parathecia that, the scab that overwinters in the leaves to survive. Any degradation of the leaves is going to prevent that environment to that is conducive for this organism to survive. So you can do any of those combined and try to get a better effect. And I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, it does. Well, excellent information. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all that great information.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Follow me on Twitter at NSTreeFruit and follow Perennia on Facebook and Twitter at NSPerennia. Thanks to Perennia for dispersing information in the podcast space. Thank you to Patty Ryan and Moira Anderson for their marketing management. And thank you to growers for asking the most infectious questions. Here's a fun fact. The anticipation of green tip makes me more nervous than the appearance of green tip. When we know it's here, we can deal with it, but the uncertainty of it being out of reach seems more daunting.